HR doesn't like you. It's today, and HR is still fighting for their right to party. After all, we're in charge of planning them, right? This podcast shares edgy, unadulterated stories and perspectives of what it truly means to work in HR. The best part? We don't necessarily like people or care if you like us. The title is The Little Mermaid Got It Wrong. And I've had this title for a couple of years because I always think about the song and she wants to be where the people are. And I love Disney. And I was like, Ariel, like, you don't even know. Come work in HR. But if you brought up like losing your voice, right? And Ariel trades her voice to like, go be where the people are, in the spirit of we're having this mass exodus of HR execs being like, fuck this shit, I don't want to do it anymore. Because I think to that point, we're so tired of fighting for our voice to like be heard and valued. Yeah.
You do have to know that your voice, like, I think it's not that you have to consciously give up your voice, but you have to know that the world is going to expect you to give up your voice. The executive team is going to, if you get a seat at the table, they're not going to expect you to be as loud as everyone else in the room. And if you are as loud as everyone else in the room, especially if you're a woman, especially if you're a person of color, you will be seen as aggressive and pushy and opinionated as a negative thing. You will have to fight harder for your voice to be heard in an equal way.
Every time I read a fellow HR practitioner's headline on LinkedIn that they are, quote, people obsessed, I have to close my eyes and look away. I've never understood this identity marker if you work in HR. And more importantly, it has always made me think of the line from Part of Your World, I want to be where the people are. While this is a classic Disney ballad, I couldn't disagree more. And I would trade all the seashells and sand dollars across all the oceans to 95% of the time not be where the people are. Thankfully, I found friends without fins who align with this sentiment, such as Kim Roer. Kim and I share a kindred introverted outlook to working in HR and why the term people obsessed is as washed up as Ariel without a voice. We dive deep into the open waters about why folks who are pursuing HR because they love people need to think long and hard about what defines their love for people, and if that actually means HR is the best career path. Because the hard truth is, the shit you deal with in HR often makes you want to clam up and sink to the bottom of the ocean where you can exist in solitude. You aren't given gadgets and gizmos aplenty to resource your job, and no one is going to save you from the CEO witch. Thank you for indulging my Little Mermaid references. Back to regular scheduled programming.
First thing that I wanted to ask you, since you've been in HR for a minute, you know, a couple years, is what did working in HR represent or mean to you when you got into it versus how you actually think about it now and what it means?
Yeah, I told this story to somebody the other day and they thought it was funny. But I got into HR because I loved documentation and I was really interested in knowing what the rules were, which, you know, hindsight being what it is, I realize now I've always been this way. Like, I want to know what the rules are so I know where the boundaries are and I know what is a real rule and what is a breakable rule.
Mm.
Like, I want to know the rules so I know how I can get around the rules. And I notice now, like, my daughter is the same way. She's like, I like knowing the rules. And then also I'm going to see how much wiggle room there is. So I think that's originally when I was getting into HR, I really was into employee handbooks and documentation and like, how do we tell new people what they need to know to be successful here? I thought that's what HR was like, we know the rules. And I knew like there was something about benefits and like, I knew HR dealt with compensation. But I was like, HR is the rules and the compliance. And I had worked at Google already and their people ops team, and I had no exposure to. I was like, we do these surveys and like, I asked someone in HR what our EAP was. And I think HR does that, but I didn't know anything. I'm telling you, I was 22. I was like, I like knowing the rules. And it seems like HR people are in charge of knowing the rules and then making up things at the company so they don't get in trouble. And now it's like, I still think that's a big and undersold part of HR because I think people think it's all about either all about people and making work a warm, fuzzy, squishy place where people can live their happiest lives, or they think it's all about rules and regulation and towing the company line. And I think it actually exists more in the gray. I think the best HR people that I've ever known are the people who understand enough about compliance to know where the lines are drawn, but also understand enough about humans to know that like sometimes it's not quite so neat and tidy and you have to know how messy can we get without breaking the law.
Mm-hmm.
so funny that you said that.
Or harming people, I should say.
Yeah, that's true. Like just that real life, I think how you operate is really interesting to tie to HR because I too, like my example is if you're driving and you see a road closed, but that's the way I want to go. I'm just like, well, let's see.
Yeah.
I don't think this road is closed. I don't think the road is closed.
Yeah. I mean, there's a street by me that's like closed except for local residents.
Right. I like to just think that I'm using my critical thinking skills when I'm assessing.
That's right. You're using your critical thinking powers for good.
I align with that a lot too. And I think that is where you meet really smart and kind of forward thinking HR practitioners is where they acknowledge that, yes, these things exist and that will always be core to the role. And yeah. I also think working in HR, you have such this intensified lens of like how humans behave. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that actually teaches you more about like what it's like to work in the profession. And that gets me into this like concept of working in HR is like you love people, right? That if you work in HR, you're obsessed with people, you love them, you want to spend all your time with them. And you and I share a lot of similar, I think, perspectives and just like human traits that we'll get into. But humans we're really messy creatures.
Deeply flawed.
And when you work in HR, you see that on, I would say, such a visceral level, if that's a word that I could use to describe that. And I believe that that's where HR becomes so misunderstood in a lot of ways is that it's not binary, right? It's not you love people and or you love compliance. Right. There's so much open water to be discovered and understood. And we see so much shit. And so oftentimes we're not going to come out the other side thinking that people are great.
You said something in a recent episode of the podcast about like how if an HR person tells you that they just love people and that's why they do HR, then they like haven't been doing it long enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just thought that was so funny and so true because I think you can do HR and still, you know, I'm not totally jaded. Like you can still keep a love of people. But if that's not balanced with the reality of like how actually fucking hard it is to be in a job that is supporting people all day long, that is caregiving for your fellow employees while no one else at the organization is responsible for taking care of you. You must have a picture of Dorian Gray situation going on somewhere where like some part of you is secretly rotting away and you're just not acknowledging it because it can't not have an impact on you. There's no way that it can. There's no way to have a meaningful career in HR without some battle scars. It's just part of the game. I mean, it's the same I talk to people in customer success about this all the time, that like it is a field where you see a lot of shit. And of course you want to have boundaries and mental health support and like find ways to protect yourself from feeling everything that you're experiencing. But like you're kidding yourself if you think it's not going to impact you at all and how you see people. It goes back to what I was saying about like, it's not all compliance and it's not all people. Like you have to be able to tie those two things together because frankly, like the compliance lens hasn't changed dramatically in the last many decades.
Yeah.
Yes, there's like new labor law all the time, but like the laws are not adequate to support the type of work and the type of behaviors and the type of experiences people are having today in 2020. Mm-hmm. So you have to be able to interpret those laws or interpret what your counsel has told you the laws mean, because we're not all experts. But you have to be able to interpret that and translate it into something that's actually going to be supportive of people.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you're dealing with people, you have to know you can't just rely on things like, well, this is the law. So toughen up, cookie. You have to be able to explain things in a way that is patient and humane and reasonable because people are smart and they want to know why things are the way they are. And they'll argue with you if they don't believe in it. You have to kind of be the first person to have those arguments and know what people are going to come at you with. And I mean, as I'm saying this, I'm like, that's exhausting.
I know. Well, I think also a very crucial trait that you never necessarily see in like an HR job description or whatnot is the required amount of creativity. And when you were talking about, okay, the law is, let's call it black and white. It is what it is. And what you were saying is like, we're also at a time in the workforce where that can, that is a steady state that exists. Right. And we're also charged with creating creative solutions, I would say, yeah, that
in a hyper-competitive talent marketplace where companies are fighting over the best talent and want to have, you know, in the tech industry, trying mm-hmm. to compete for the best work environments possible. Or in other industries, they might be trying to compete for, you know, bottom line or whatever. Like, you have to balance creating the right environment for your business with what is literally the law.
Mm-hmm. And what we've seen, like being down in the trenches is in HR, is that like, that's not always one, that's not always fun. And two, I would imagine maybe someone who listens to this and continues to hear that I don't really like people would say that I'm just like jaded and bitter, but to me, it's lived experience. And yeah. I am curious what you think, and I'm sure you've seen a lot of this maybe in more junior HR folks, or you've interviewed people who want to get into HR, or even, you know, the company that you're leading of training and providing a platform for people to learn HR skills. Like, you've heard this term people obsessed. And mm-hmm. anytime I hear that, I just am like, who, like, what, where do you come from? Like, I do not want to be where the people are. I don't, you know, that is such a, it's such a departure from how I view the profession. And I'm just curious, what do you, like, what is invoked in you when you hear that yeah. HR people are people obsessed? And like, where do you think this came from? Yeah. And what does it really mean when people say that?
I think it's, I mean, tragically, I think it is a, it's just a buzzword. I think it's something that grew from the world of product and tech, of like, we're mission obsessed, we're customer obsessed. This like obsessive nature being the goal, and people saying, I question it when a company says we're mission obsessed. I'm like, okay, what does that mean to you?
Yeah.
What does it mean to be mission obsessed? Tell me in words and show me in actions what that actually means. Cause it's not enough to say that you're obsessed with something. I want to know what it means. When you say you're customer obsessed, does that mean that you'll keep your employees working late at night if a customer needs a problem because you're obsessed with your customer needing to have the best of everything? Like, I've worked at companies where they have said like, yes, our customers come before everything, even yeah. our own well-being. And I'm like, well, that's fucked up. But when you say you're people obsessed, I get really curious. What does it mean to be people obsessed? What yeah. does that look like in your policies? What does that look like in your practices? What does that look like in how you provide support to people internally? I feel like when I think about being people obsessed, I think about like, are you obsessed with the problems that people have and finding ways to solve them? Mm-hmm. Or are you just like really into people and you want to know everything about everyone? Like, mm-hmm. it could go a lot of different ways, right?
Like, yeah.
A word is only as strong as you can define it. And I think people tend to use it as a shorthand for, I love people and I want to take care of people. And all I think yeah. about all day is how well people are doing at the company and how I can support them. That's the only thing I think about. That's yeah. like people obsessed. But that's also not a scalable career.
Yeah.
You have to be able to balance you have to focus your people obsession and define it in a way that serves the needs of the people and the business and your own well-being.
Yeah. How would you redirect someone who comes to you and says, I want to work in HR because I love people?
Oh, you mean like all the time? I would say, what do you love about people? What do you want to do with that love? I've never said it quite that way before, but I kind of like that. Like, you love people. Yeah. What does it look like for you to have a job that satisfies your love of people? What does that look like? What kinds of things do you expect that you would be doing? What kinds of things would you want to be doing to demonstrate how much you love people, or to satisfy the part of you that's like, I just love people. I love people so much. I want to work in HR. What about HR seems like it appeals to you and your love of people? Because that is part of the job. There's part of the job that like you have to care about people.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I feel like many jobs require, user experience design requires that you care about people and the experience they have with your product.
Mm-hmm.
But I just get really curious with folks and ask questions like, what does that mean to you? Tell me more about that.
Mm-hmm.
What tasks do you see yourself doing that would let you share your love of people? And
yeah.
that's something actually, you know, you mentioned the training program that's part of the company that I run, where our next program is going to be focusing on the HR curious, really early career folks
yeah.
to help people come up with the language to define that. Because a lot of people, I do career coaching, a lot of people I coach
mm-hmm.
are not in HR. And they say, well, I just really love people and I want to help people. So HR seems like a good fit for me. But they don't know the full scope of what it means to work in HR, all the different facets of an HR career, how frustrating it can be, how rewarding it can be. And like getting people familiar with the ins and outs of like really specific, what does it mean to work in compensation and benefits?
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to work in talent acquisition? What does it mean to work in HR business partner, manager, coach, coaching? What is it, you know, like all of these different things require a different combination of skills. And yeah. there's overlap. And so, you know, in many companies, you end up being the one person who's doing all of those things, but right. it's not enough to just like people. That's yeah. not enough, because the job is yeah. so much bigger than that, right? That's not the whole job.
I talked about this in just my last episode where it was just me and I was kind of having some catharsis. But the thing that makes me so sad and really hurts my feelings when people think about HR, even they want to get into HR, is it is a very technical job. Mm-hmm. And like if I want to charge forward on anything in HR, I want to continue to like sound that horn, because yeah. I just think that people, and especially, you know, the leaders that we are required to partner with, just don't view our profession as a technical one. And mm-hmm. and that's where I want to have conversations that are bringing that forward of like, what does that mean? Yeah. Because yeah. it's funny. I always used to tell my sister growing up, it scarred her for life. I love you, but I don't like you. And I think that's probably like what's informed a lot of me. This HR work on a subliminal level. Like, of course, if you've chosen to be in a position where you're advocating, is the word that I like to use, for, you know, this group of humans that you've decided to work alongside, like, of course, you're, to your point, like, you care deeply about that and you care deeply about people. You wouldn't be like fighting the ins and outs.
That doesn't mean you want to hang out with them.
Yeah. Or that like you like their personality.
Yeah. Like it's that thing of like, just like you can want people to be successful and you can want people to have a fulfilling, joyful experience at work, but not be friends with them. And that's a thing that like, I feel like I've been yelling about this a lot lately, but no other department is expected to be friends with employees in the same way that HR is expected to be friends with employees. Mm. And yet HR is probably the department that is least able to be friends with employees, even if you wanted to be. Because, you know, HR, it's hard to fire your friend. I've done it several times. Like, it's hard to give negative performance feedback to the person you're going to go get drinks with after work.
Yeah.
It's possible. You sure can do it, but it complicates things. And I think it's, you know, when people are talking about HR being the fun police and HR being the whatever, it's like, we're expected to plan the parties, but we're also not expected to be encouraging of fun. All of these things just make it really complicated to build true, meaningful relationships with our coworkers.
Yeah.
You're sort of othered and separated in that way.
Yeah.
But then also it's like, HR is not your friend. HR doesn't care about you. It's like, well, are you over here being like, engineering's not your friend, finance is not your friend?
Yeah.
Like, no, nobody's saying that shit.
Yeah. I mean, I have so much inclusion trauma from working in HR.
That's a good way to put it.
Just like from not being included on leadership teams to.
Oh, yeah.
And it's funny because I've had this conversation a lot with my first boss when I graduated from grad school and got my first big girl HR job. And I had a boss who we're now really good friends, but she demonstrated very strong boundaries. And so that was like my first exposure and learning. And I actually really respected that she did that. You know, she had rules like no social media, right? Which is, I still hold that rule, you know, and like you don't hang out with people outside of work. And yeah. I think as you evolve in your career, you can maybe explore the nuances more. But honestly, for me, having kind of that hard line was, I think, really helpful establishing like myself in this position. And it's actually something that I would lead with in talking to someone, right? If they wanted to get an R, is like, again, the misconception. Like, you can love people, but you're not necessarily going to get to have the interactions that you think that you want or that this role permits, because you have to have more boundaries, in my opinion, than anyone in the organization.
Yeah. And you have to be able to feel confident enough in those boundaries to reinforce them when, you know, when you get that. I mean, nobody's doing Facebook anymore, I don't think. But like, I remember back in the day being talking to coworkers and being like, hey, just FYI, I don't accept friend requests from current coworkers because it gets too messy. Mm-hmm. People respected that and they probably talked shit about me behind my back. And like, that's fine. I was okay with that. And I think it gets really blurry in the world today when we're using social media for work purposes, when we're using, you know, LinkedIn all the time, we're on Twitter for work or whatever people are using, TikTok. I don't know.
Yes.
I know HR people. I don't use.
Don't hang out on those playgrounds. So
like, I am a geriatric millennial. I use Friendster. I don't
MySpace.
Know. I don't know. But this idea of, look, I'm biased. I am an introvert. I am biased against this. But I think it's really hard in HR to to have those types of social bonds. Because again, I think it's also, it's hard to have those kind of social bonds and also be seen as an equal executive leader. Mm-hmm. Because if you're like partying with the employees, like probably your most senior executives are not doing that. Right.
Yeah.
And like, but like you said, there's this inclusion problem of I can plan the parties, but I don't really attend the party because I'm running the party. And there's some instances where that is the most appropriate thing, like planning the holiday party and running the holiday party. At some point in time, when do you clock out? Like, are those hours on the clock that I'm at the holiday party because I'm working? Because I'm working the party.
Yeah.
So if I'm on the clock and I'm working the party and I see somebody engaging in inappropriate behavior, is it my responsibility as HR to sober up real quick and go deal with the harassment issue that I'm seeing in the corner of the holiday party?
Yeah.
Do I wait until the party's over and someone reports it to me and I'm like, oh, I didn't see that. Sorry, I missed it.
Yeah.
It's really, really tricky. And you have to sort of, I really think I like honed my lack of FOMO muscles, my JOMO, my joy of missing out muscles in this era of my career, being like, I serve a different role in this organization. Mm-hmm. And what are the boundaries that I need to create in this role? And I like, it worked for me, again, as an introverted person who was like, I like kind of an excuse to draw that social boundary and like protect my energy levels. Mm-hmm. But for more extroverted people who really crave that social connection, you might have to seek that outside of work, or you might have to lead into developing those relationships with fellow executives. Mm-hmm. Although that can be tricky too, because you know, sometimes you have to fire an executive and they're your buddy and they want to be all buddy with you. And you're like, hey, actually, we need to work on your performance improvement plan. And it's challenging. It's a challenging line between trust building and relationship building and like turning it into a social buddy. That's a delicate balance.
Have you ever had an experience where you, whatever boundaries you have, right? Everyone is allowed to have their own boundaries. And I think you, again, you have to redefine them as you become, you know, more senior and especially in an executive position. But has there ever been a time where you kind of like forewent one of your boundaries and it like bit you in the ass?
Yeah, there's a couple examples I'll share. They're short examples. One is that more than once I had hired a friend to be my direct report early in my career, and it was very challenging. It was someone that I was like, you know, like medium friends, but like we weren't like super close friends, but we were definitely friends. And I hired them, and they worked for me. And when there were performance challenges, I found it as a relatively new manager, I found it very challenging to give them the kind of firm feedback I needed to give without damaging the friendship. And that resulted in me, as a person who is also largely a non-confrontational person, it made it really hard for me because I like could not give this person the feedback I knew I needed to give them. Because every time we got together, it was like, let's talk about this. Let's talk about this. It's like, no, this is your one-on-one. We need to talk about this thing. Why have you done it yet? Or I need to give you feedback. It was really, really hard. It mostly bit me in the ass for like me and my own well-being.
Yeah.
And with this employee, because I kept dragging the inevitable, like, give you the feedback I need to give you. The other example I will share that it didn't bite me in the ass, but it really could have. And I just got lucky. And it's been long enough now that I can talk about it. The company I was working for had recently been acquired, and it was the first holiday party since the acquisition. And we had had sort of legendarily fun and scrappy holiday parties up until this point. And we were asked to be even scrappier, but also the party kind of sucked because the acquiring company was going to be there and they were like draining the life out of us. And I decided that the only way I was going to get through this party was by getting high. Because I didn't want to get drunk, because drinking, you know, open bar, tech party, whatever. But I was like, if I drink, I'm going to get sloppy. And I don't want to do that. But I was like, a little bit of weed that will calm my nerves, I will be okay. I got a little more high than I intended to, because I was very upset and anxious about the way this party was going. Certain senior executives had like fled and were hiding in the bathrooms because they didn't want to hear the new executive leadership giving speeches. People were like, some of our employees were getting rowdy, and we had someone who was like told they were being fired at the party. It was a big old mess. And because I was not sober, I just kind of was like standing on the sidelines, like watching, being like, oh, like, this is not good.
Yeah.
But I definitely am not sober enough to do anything about any of this right now. So I just sort of had like an out of body experience at that at that party and felt like I can really be an effective HR professional because I had entered, well, fuck this, the acquiring company.
Yeah.
They're going to fire me anyway because they don't need another HR person. I'm just going to be a guest at this party now.
Yeah.
And then I had moments where I was like, oh, fuck, I really need to be an HR person at this party now.
Mm.
And like nothing like tremendously bad happened. Even if I had been fully sober, I would not have been able to prevent drunk employees from saying things more loudly than they should have during speeches. But the next day I was like, probably shouldn't do that again. Probably should like stay more sober at corporate events.
Mm. Well, thanks for sharing that.
Hey, you know, we have to be vulnerable, right?
Yeah. I can't remember if I don't know. I'm sure I have. I remember kind of the opposite where like I was dead sober at a company party and, you know, you just like the meltdowns start happening. And this was a company where they called themselves a family and it was like incestuous, like the CEO sleeping with someone, you know, like, and I just remember like going upstairs in the conference room and like everyone is having a meltdown and like sharing their deepest, darkest secrets. And the next day, right? Not everyone remembers those conversations. And I'm sitting here being like, how do you discern that it was just like the company party, right? What you were witnessing of like people just like losing their shit. And I think it just comes back to this concept of the inclusion of our role. And like, if you want to get into,
how are you being included? And what are you being like, included in?
You often have to make those decisions that you will always, I think to an extent, even if you partake in outside events, like you will always be seen as on. Like I remember I joined a new company and the first day I was at the executive retreat. That was like my first day and like all really great people. But we were like driving in the car to go to dinner and someone made a comment like, oh, well, like we have HR. Oh, HR is here now. So like we can't say that anymore. And I was they were just like saying like, we can't talk like that or the policing. And I was like, you only get to say that once because it's such a it may seem like in jest in the moment and but like haha, HR is money you. But it goes back to this like just the disrespect of our role and what the value that we bring to the table and what we're actually here to do. And it's not like love people and police you and you know it's not the binary like one or the other. And it just again I think if you do care deeply and you understand like, you can't help but not like, that kind of erodes your soul a little bit.
I'm so glad these conversations are happening now. And I hope to find a more scalable way to teach companies, teach people what the true value and role of HR is.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I was starting out, I remember I had some employees at my first startup, when they left and went to work at other companies, they would come back to me and say things like, wow, I didn't know how good we had it. Like, I didn't realize how much you were doing.
Yeah.
I didn't realize how spoiled I was by the way that you built these things. And now here I am at this other company and like, wow, it's not like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a shame to me that that's like, it takes people having a good experience and then going somewhere else and having a bad experience to realize how powerful it can be. Because otherwise, if all you have is bad experiences, then you're just going to think bad things about HR because you're going to blame HR for all of the bad experiences. Mm-hmm. I've even been blamed for managers being bad managers because HR should have fixed them. It's like, if you don't know how good it can be, you don't know the full scope of the work. You don't see how many things HR is touching in the organization. Mm-hmm. Then I can't blame you for not having a well-rounded understanding of our profession.
Mm-hmm.
Because how are you supposed to learn? You don't have exposure to it.
Mm-hmm.
How can we expose more people to the work that our teams are doing?
Mm-hmm. And I do think that both HR practitioners and everyone else who has not worked a damn second in HR is perpetuating language that is not aligned with like this conversation that you and I are having, who have almost combined 30 years of HR experience, right? Like, but these loud voices, and especially if you are in the echo chamber of LinkedIn, it's just so like wrong and like foul in some ways.
Yeah.
And I pulled up this quote that I want to read because I think it's very well in sync with what we're saying right now from the former VP of HR at Microsoft. So I guess a legit company if you want to think Microsoft is that.
Sure,
but this person is saying that HR is paid by the company to solve problems either between employees or with the company and its policies. And he says some silly things, but the most silly thing is even if the other person is the problem, don't expect HR to automatically rush to your aid. In many ways, HR is like the police. They rush to the scene, get the issue under control, and turn their objective report over to the company and its management. If this quote is like not even 2 years old and from one of the biggest companies, most recognized brands in the world, you know, someone who is at the helm of HR is spouting this kind of shit, like, we don't have a chance.
Right. Well, that's what you see in this toxic discourse is like HR represents the business and HR is not your friend and HR is just there to make things hard for you or to get between you and what's right. And that's not true. First of all, it just renders me speechless because I think in a lot of cases, what HR is there to do is to be in between the employee and the business need and to take a neutral stance on the issue, to learn as much as possible about what's going on, and then help guide the company in action in the way that is going to balance the needs of the employee and the needs of the business. And sometimes that balance is not 50-50. Sometimes the end result is it's not going to be good for the business if we make this super pro-employee decision, if we choose not to put this person on a performance plan, or we choose that we like want to add this benefit in because people are demanding it. Like sometimes you have to do the thing that's the right decision for the business. When this comes up all the time in layoffs, people are like, well, if HR really cared about you, there wouldn't be layoffs, something I heard. And I was like, A, like how much power do you think we have?
Yeah. Yeah.
And like B, the point isn't that HR is there to protect you from everything that's going to happen in the business. The HR is there to translate between employee and business and business and employee. And that's why it can be such a draining and challenging job.
Yeah.
You're sitting at that middle point where business leaders don't think you're business savvy enough and people don't think you're people focused enough. Mm-hmm. And somehow you have to be the best at both of those things so that you can balance the needs of both.
Yeah.
And it just drives me crazy when people say that HR's job is to protect the business, because that's just a very outdated way of thinking of the role of HR.
Yeah.
And it's not progressive. It's not modern. We're in 2020, and the last 4 years has seen a radical transformation in the way we think about work.
Yeah.
So what are we doing to like rise up to meet the needs of the workforce that exists today?
Yeah. It's so interesting because I saw an article recently from HBR, Harvard Business Review, of HR's new role. Did you see this? I haven't read it, but I actually learned something which I didn't even know about HR, but it connected so many dots, is that HR was originally, I guess one of the original intentions of its formation was to protect businesses from union, to advocate for employees so they wouldn't unionize.
Right.
So to keep unions out of business.
Right.
So that is where we started, right? And that's where I think this like protect the business comes from. And I was just like, wow, I get it. And that was 50 plus years ago, I think, is what it stated, like the 1900s or something, that was, you know, where we came from. But I just thought it was so fascinating because anytime, and I know very well educated people who say HR is there to protect the business, and like my brain just starts to bleed because it's so wrong. And, you know, I want to circle back to what you said about being an introvert, because I think that's where you and I have bonded in our approach and how we see the HR world as like being HR and being really good at HR and also being an introvert. The job titles that I like to assign myself are detective and like mastermind and like what you're saying, like acrobat of like this tightrope, right? That you always are having to walk. All maybe seem funny and whatever. Inflamed of what we actually do. But for me, you are always being a detective in the organization of like figuring out what's going on. What are people saying, right? That's kind of why I love HR, is you get to know everything. Kind of what you were saying, like you want to know all the information and like how you then make decisions from there. And I think that's the same of like, you should know everything. And the mastermind piece comes in when you're like, okay, I have all this information more than any other person in the organization has. That's the kind of power that I like and that I have. And I use that to inform the decision. So when you go to your executive team or whatever, and they think that you're just pulling, you know, whatever, clouds out of the sky on these things, it's like, no, you are so informed with like your ear, like all the way buried under the ground, that you know this to be true.
Right.
And no one gives that to us. And also, like, do you ever find that you have all this information and you have to sometimes like play dumb or placate?
My God, all the time.
Because you're just like, I know everything.
Oh yeah. I mean, one example I have for you, I didn't play dumb because I was like, fuck this, is, you know, Just like a PSA for all the CEOs out there who don't want to pay their chief people officers appropriately. You know that we have all the salary data, right?
Yes, yeah.
When you are underpaid as an HR leader and you have access to all of the salary data and you look at, you are managing the spreadsheet, right? It's like, I know how much every single person at this company makes. I know what percentile they're in. I have the market data. They're coming to me to make compensation decisions for everyone on their team. So why is it that I am underpaid?
Mm-hmm.
And like, I know all of this, and I know a lot of HR leaders that have, like, that I've coached who are like, well, I know that I'm underpaid because I saw this information because I run payroll or because I do the comp review or because I do the blah, blah, blah. And so I figured out that I'm being underpaid, but like, I don't want to bring it up because I don't want it to look like I was snooping around for reasons to get paid more. I don't want to look like I'm using the data for my own advantage. I don't want to look bad in front of the other leaders by like pointing out to the CEO that I used our compensation data to like find something out that I shouldn't have.
Yeah, that you're
out.
Like weaponizing the information you have as part of your
That's
job.
Exactly right. Right. A lot of the things that I've coached these leaders through is like how to bring that up and how to have that conversation in a transparent and ethical way. Because of course, if you see something and you can use it to your own advantage, you have to weigh the ethical boundaries of like, is this a case where I like have to pretend that I'm a regular employee and I don't know this information. And so I have to, you know, it's like insider trading, right? Like, but when it comes to things like unfair or discriminatory practices, I think it's totally legit to say, hey, like I'm not over here running calculations to prove that some harm is being done to me, but like, I couldn't help but notice as I was putting together the compensation for the whole company that our average is 50th percentile, but I'm at 25th percentile. And I was wondering why that is. And if we can have a conversation about bringing me up to a comparable percentile with the rest of the team.
Yeah.
There are ways to have these conversations. I had another example of this and now it's gone, but maybe it'll come back.
Yeah. I have two inflection points on that topic. And I actually think it's really important. So I want to keep talking about it a little.
Yeah.
It was my first role and I was, you know, very junior level paid. It was a nonprofit also, you know, and back then there was like no pay bands, nothing existed in that organization where, you know, it was really like, it was such a hard reality to learn. And I think it's really important for people. Again, you need to you want to have the facts when you decide to get into HR, and hopefully these conversations and what you're bringing through your organization, Peak HR, and this new, you know, this upcoming cohort that you are speaking to, it's giving people the facts. And one of that is like, you're going to see what everyone makes. And it's really hard, you know, because I was at that time, the head of HR was making 3x that I was and didn't do jack shit in her role. And it was so frustrating. And then fast forward to a couple organizations later, I was in charge of redoing the whole compensation structure from philosophy, putting in pay bands, like nothing really of that existed. And I remember that it was so hard because, okay, we objectively defined all the pay bands. We were doing market adjustments, right? So some people were going to get really big increases because they were underpaid. And now we had the data. And I remember I was doing this in partnership with the CFO and it was a very contentious project to work on in general, but I advocated for the CFO to get an adjustment. And based on what we had built together and the data, I was supposed to get, and the CFO didn't, like, just kept not acknowledging it. And finally I had to be like, I'm in this band. And then they were like, And it goes back to, you have to build, we have to build the structures that not only are we advocating for others, but like we also have to advocate it for ourselves. But can you imagine being in that position? Again, it's just another very, maybe it can seem tactical, but it's so deep of the kind of shit that you probably will encounter.
It's very emotional. Yes. It's a very emotional thing to gain access to things that demonstrate the inequities that are impacting you. And to take that and sit with it and think about it and figure out, do I want to do something with this information? Whether that's, you know, you're realizing that you're the only person in the company that's never had a performance review because you're just like casually having conversations with the CEO. And so you've never had a proper conversation about your role or, you know, whatever it may be. It's really challenging. And that's why you have to build these structures and systems in place to reduce bias. And you have to make sure that you are an included participant in these systems. And so that's something that I remember doing this with with many executive teams saying, okay, well, here's our program, here's our process for, like, let's say for promotions. How are we going to address performance as an executive team? Because all of us are accountable for our performance as well. But, you know, if you're a VP level executive or a C level executive, you're not getting promoted. There's not going to be changes to your job very often, but you still need to be able to have give and receive feedback that is performance driven. You still need to know when your compensation may be adjusted. Who's going to give me performance feedback?
Yeah.
Who's going to be determining my comp adjustment? Who's mm-hmm. going to be responsible for these things? Because otherwise you get very cobbler's children have no shoes in HR.
And just like going on what you said is it's the emotional labor. And this what we're talking about is just the mental calisthenics that we have to go through in, yeah. in our role, right? And going yeah. back to the other roles of being the detective and the mastermind and if you are bringing it back to if you're an introvert mm-hmm. and these things are so emotionally draining and maybe you're right, you're dealing with your own yeah. your own role. I think, yeah, no one ever views HR as also being an employee of the organization.
You don't have needs, right?
Yeah. How do you navigate being an HR introvert? I've talked about this a lot on the podcast, especially when my coach was on, but I've had people be like, you probably shouldn't work in HR because it just sucks the life out of you. And it's like, no, like, but I love it. How do you navigate that?
Well, again, it comes down to defining expectations and like, what is the expectation of the role that you are in? And there are some roles in HR that would not be a good fit for me and that aren't a good fit for me. And I've learned over the years, like these are the HR tasks that I should not be responsible for because I don't like them and they're not good for me. And this was a dominant issue for me in the last company I worked for, Oyster, which is a distributed remote company across 70 countries. We had a lot of work to do on the employee experience side around engagement and around connection and fostering social connection because there's no physical office space. I like to say we had 650 offices because every single employee worked from home. Like, how do you build connection and foster community and like do that? And for me as an HR leader, I don't really care because all of my social needs are being met by the thousands of one-on-ones I get dragged into or like meetings I get dragged into. And I have friends outside of work and I have young children.
Your family.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, I am not looking for more social connection with my coworkers outside of like what I already have. And I was like, if it was left to just me to be the social planner for the company, people who have different needs, whether it's because they're extroverted or because they're earlier in their career or because they just like to socialize more or they're lonely, like whatever the reasons are, those people would not be getting their needs met because I would be like, this is the bottom of my priority list. I'm not going to plan social gatherings. I can't. I know it needs to happen, but I had a person on my team who I made it an official formal part of her role because she loved social connection. She loved people in that she loved meeting people, learning about them, knowing their stories, having personal connections with them, building relationships. It was draining for her at times because, you know, when you're that one person for 650 people, that's a lot. But she really enjoyed coming up with creative ways to build connection internally. And I was like, I am outsourcing this to you. Mm-hmm. It's a strategic growth opportunity for you because we're going to set a goal together of like, we need to have X number of events per quarter, or we need to have this type of score on our engagement surveys, or we want this kind of reaction. But other than that, like your strategy, your choice, how do you want to build connection on this remote team? Mm-hmm. And I had that experience at a startup where we were all in person as well. It's like, I know that it is important for us to do bonding activities. This is where I feel like I get like sort of neurodiversity detachment where I'm like, I know the facts are that it is important for social bonding to occur in the workplace. However, I am not the person who is equipped to execute this task. Who on our team, who on the people team is going to be the liaison? If they're like, if we don't have someone on the team already who is the party planner type, who is going to be the form a culture committee or form a social crew? Flag us if you need help executing, but otherwise, like, go forth and prosper.
Yeah. Well, I think it's the fastest track to burnout if you are having to exert energy towards things that don't give you energy, that are not your strength or whatever. And I would say, especially if you're a team of one, which a lot of HR folks are, this like by committee is so powerful because, and I even have done that within diversity and inclusion committees. Mm-hmm. Okay, who likes to who likes to plan, who wants to do the volunteer event coordination, who wants to write the diversity statement, right? You're going to find that the co-collaboration is actually so much, there's so much interest and it's so powerful and it's going to help you be a better leader, especially if you are an introvert.
Yeah. Well, I know you're a strengths girly. So let people play to their strengths. I have determined that over this last year of self-discovery that like the most toxic trait that has been, I don't know how to turn that into a verb. The most toxic expectation for HR leaders is that we are expected to be and do everything. It is so impossible. There's such a narrow, and I think probably non-existent profile of a person who can be and do all of these things. And instead of letting HR leaders play to their strengths and build teams who can support the areas where they're not as strong, like we do with every other fucking department, HR is just expected to take it all on. It's like, I might be really, really good at like operationalizing things and like making things programmatic. I might be really good at strategic blue sky vision. I might be really good at social connection dynamics and like human behavior psychology. When you're hiring an HR person or at any level, really, but especially at the like the senior leadership level, what is it that your organization needs? What is the strategic gap that you're looking to fill? And how can you hire someone with those skills who you will trust to build a team to support the other areas of their excellence? Mm-hmm. Like this was the greatest part of our team at Oyster was for a long time, for a year. It was a long time in the course of the company's startup life. Well, I was going to say the company is like barely 4 years old. It was half of my tenure. But for a good half of my tenure, we had a team that was divided up of senior leaders that all reported to one CPO who had a specific remit and he had responsibilities that were suited to his strengths. And each one of us could form project teams or form bodies of work around what we were good at. And it takes a lot of practice. And I realized in that experience that it takes a lot of unlearning. And I credit my coworker, friend, peer mentor, Erin Marshall, who's their current VP of people. I credit her so much for this because she is also a person who does a lot of introspection and was able to say things like, why are you volunteering for this task? Like, this is not in your zone of genius. This does not play to your strength. And I was like, well, because somebody has to do it. She's like, but why you? Well, because I could do it. She's like, then she would say to me, you could do it, but it's going to take you, it's going to take so much more out of you than it would take for someone on our team who loves doing this stuff and is really good at it. Like, why are you trying to be someone you're not? And I realize it's like, because I've spent the last 15 years of my career being told that I need to be something that I'm not. And so I just expect that that's the way it's supposed to be. I have to be bubbly and extroverted all day long in the office. And I have to make sure, to your point on another podcast, that like my face looks right when I'm at my desk so that people don't get worried. I have to make sure that I'm like smiling customer service representative, ready to support everyone. And I also have to be tough as nails business bitch in the back as I'm, you know, cutting people's budgets. And I also have to be, you look at the job descriptions and it's like, we need a strategic thinker who can imagine the future of work, who also isn't afraid to get their hands dirty and roll up their sleeves and really execute.
I've seen it so much.
Why are we expecting people to be everything? It's just insane.
And I would extend that to if you are free agents, like you and I both are, if you're looking for a new role, make sure that you're holding that same criteria. Especially taking the lived experience, right? And if you're starting your HR career, like you're going to learn this and you're kind of going to collect what is informs how you look for a next role. But I think where you and I are at in our careers, you crystallize that so much more. And like, I have worked in startups for the last half a decade and I'm kind of like, I don't know if I have it in me to do another startup, right? Oh, like the emotional labor. And like, I just say, I can't get it up for you. It's just the work this time around. So I would say it goes to extends to that as well.
I mean, there's a reason that so many senior executive HR leaders have left the workforce and gone in, well, not the total workforce, left the in-house workforce and gone into consulting, gone into fractional HR or consulting in HR or gone into VC, gone into other places. There's the classic thing of when they hire you as a consultant, they'll do whatever you tell them. But if you're that person in-house, then they argue everything you say, right? And it's tiring. And I find that so many of us, and I say us, in this broader community that I'm in of people who are fractional people leaders, and the majority have been through two or three tech startups and then have burnt out. And they're like, I cannot do this work in this way anymore. And so until businesses change the way they work with their HR professionals, this is going to keep happening. It's one of the reasons that we founded Peak HR is because so many of these seasoned leaders are leaving the the workforce and going fractional, which mm-hmm. means that younger, more junior folks are getting promoted up into roles they're not ready for, and they don't have anyone to learn from. And so we're like, that's one of the reasons we started this, was like, we need to connect the next generation with leaders who can lift them up and mm-hmm. teach them about boundaries and teach them how to be strategic leaders while also, you know, getting shit done and, you know, help people survive the next kind of generation of this work, because mm-hmm. it is an often invisible, thankless job mm-hmm. by nature. And I like to say it's like any ops role, where if you're doing your job well, people don't notice. And it's very taxing to be in that role for 15 years.
Well, you brought up this really insightful note in our prep about your HR voice and giving up your voice. And the title is The Little Mermaid Got It Wrong. And I've had this title for a couple of years because I always think about the song and she wants to be where the people are. And I love Disney. And I was like, Ariel, like, you don't even know. Come work in HR. Ariel. But you brought up like losing your voice, right? And Ariel trades mm-hmm. her voice to like, go be where the people are, in the spirit of we're having this mass exodus of HR execs being like, fuck this shit, I don't want to do it anymore. Because I think to that point, we're so tired of fighting for our voice to like be heard and valued. Yeah.
You do have to know that your voice, like, I think it's not that you have to consciously give up your voice, but you have to know that the world is going to expect you to give up your voice. The executive team is going to, if you get a seat at the table, they're not going to expect you to be as loud as everyone else in the room. And if you are as loud as everyone else in the room, especially if you're a woman, especially if you're a person of color, you will be seen as aggressive and pushy and opinionated as a negative mm-hmm. thing. You will have to fight harder for your voice to be heard in an equal way. And I think, so that's one angle. It is expected by the culture that exists right now that as an HR person, you are giving up your voice in a certain way to be an HR, to be a silent observer and mediator. And like, your role is like neutral, back of house. You don't have opinions on things. You just get things executed. But also, I think there's an empowering element of choosing not to use your voice that I think HR people need to like learn and let go of, where I just was coaching someone on this week, where they said like, the company is making a bad decision and I can't stop them. The executive team is making a bad people decision. And I've given them the data. I've given them the anecdotal evidence. I've talked to them. I've like stood on my soapbox and shouted about this, and they're not listening. And then my advice to her was, then it's time to stop talking. If they're not listening mm-hmm. and they're going to just steamroll you no matter what, you are wasting your energy, and that's taking away from energy you could be spending doing other things. So mm-hmm. what I want you to do is document your recommendations, put it in writing, and say, mm-hmm. I just want to say one last time, here's why I don't recommend we do X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. What I recommend is that we do A, B, and C. But ultimately, this is your company. It's your decision. And I respect the decision that you're making, and I will support you in executing to it. Put it in writing, send it to them so that there is a record that covers your ass when this all blows up and the company gets sued.
Mic drop.
Boom. I had a wonderful CEO once who referred to things like this as practicing selective negligence, which is a tool that I train all of my like baby mentees on when they're like, I have too many things to do. How am I supposed to do all of these things? Mm-hmm. Like, you can't. It's not possible. So mm-hmm. make a list of all the different things you're doing and selectively choose which ones you're just going to stop doing. Mm-hmm. Consequences be damned. Yeah. And tell your CEO you're going to do this. Tell them like, I cannot do all of these things. I'm going to prioritize the things I think are most important, and we'll see what breaks. And mm-hmm. that's a very quick way to get additional headcount.
Yeah. And it's such an important lesson that I think you're speaking to, that you kind of just have to walk through a little bit yourself. I know we've talked a lot in this conversation about, if you want to get into HR, it's this, not that, you know. That doesn't mean you can't still choose the path if you hold some of these mental models of why you want to work in HR. But like, learning to not care so deeply, mm-hmm. which goes back to this whole concept that for me of why I cheekily call it HR doesn't like you, because it's true and it's not. And often like, we care so much and we're like fighting day in and day out. And it's really hard for us to not care.
The title of my newsletter is literally "I Care Too Much," because that I think is the like that's the blessing and curse of being in HR. It's like, you're generally in it because you care, not mm-hmm. because you like everybody and want to be everybody's friend and want to hug your coworkers and take them out for beers, but because you care about the experience that people have at work. We spend so much of our lives at work. Chances are if you got into HR, it's because you want to make work better for people. You care about making work better for people. And I think that often gets conflated with you must love people, or how can you be an introvert and be in HR? Or like, why don't you ever come out with us after work? Or like, how come you're not doing the donut calls on Slack? Or like, you should eat lunch with the team more often. All of these criticisms that we get are social criticisms. They're not like competency of job duties. I'm like, where in my job duties does it say I eat lunch with my coworkers every day? Where in my job duties does it say that I have regular social Zooms with my coworkers? I squeeze them into my day that's already packed with Zooms from beginning to end. Like, that's not part of my job. That's not something I need to do my job well. And that I think is the big challenge with this, you know, HR isn't your friend, HR doesn't like you thing. It's like, HR's job is not to be liked. HR's job is not to like everybody else.
I think that's a great way to end.
Yeah. So sorry we don't like you.
Sorry. Not sorry ever. HR Doesn't Like You is presented by Fun Police Press and hosted by Emily McMahon. It would be so nice if you rated the podcast, and better yet, send us an email for topic requests or general commiseration. Our email is hello@hrdoesn'tlikeyou.com. That's hello@hrdoesntlikeyou.com. See you soon.